Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the latest exchange of fighting between Hezbollah and Israel. Does it bring us closer to a regional war? And will ceasefire negotiations for the Gaza conflict, the root of it all, ever come to an agreement? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Gideon Long, and on this edition, American football, the NFL votes for private equity investment. What does that mean for one of the world's richest sports leagues? We hear what's being done to prevent a potential ecological disaster in the Red Sea, and we're looking at the pros and cons of hiring older workers.
Part of the success of a factory would be having a good age range mix, and I think you need that mix. We can pass on the skills to the younger generation.
That's all to come, but let's start in Germany, because Britain's relatively new Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, is in Berlin today, trying to reset relations with Europe following Brexit, the United Kingdom's exit from the European Union 4 years ago. He's meeting German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. They're negotiating a new treaty designed to deepen trade links and boost defence cooperation. They hope to sign it by the end of this year. Here's how Keir Starmer described the plan.
A new UK-Germany treaty, a once-in-a-generation chance to deliver for working people in Britain and in Germany. A new agreement, a testament to the depth and potential of our relationship, with deeper links on science, technology, development, people, business, culture, a boost to our trading relations.
For his part, Mr. Scholz said the COVID pandemic and Brexit had caused a massive decline in contacts between the two countries, both of which have economies that are among the six biggest in the world. He said the pact could help with a wider reset between London and the EU.
It is also important for us to further develop relations between the European Union and Great Britain. I'm delighted that Keir Starmer has announced that he'll seek a fresh start in relations with the EU. We want to grab this extended hand.
Well, Tobias Meyer is chief executive of International Logistics Group DHL, which is headquartered in Germany. He says Brexit has tied up hundreds of staff with extra bureaucracy.
What happened during Brexit is very unfortunate for the British people. And I think many by now have recognized that goods get more expensive, processes get more cumbersome. We employ an additional hundreds of people in the UK and in Europe to do paperwork. That is not making the lives of people any better. It doesn't provide better access to goods and services. It's just bureaucracy that was added. And we're all not happy with some things happening in Brussels and these guys inventing new bureaucracy. But Brexit did a multifold of that in terms of constraining trade. And, you know, we've seen the exports from the UK, particularly from SMEs, plummeting after Brexit because they couldn't put up with all those additional requirements and the cost related to them. So getting back onto a track to simplify trade relationships, I think, is in the interest of both Germany and the European Union as well as the UK.
I'm joined by our political correspondent, Rob Watson. Rob, first question, why is this a bilateral treaty? Surely if you're dealing with Germany, wouldn't it be an EU-wide agreement?
It depends what it's about, Gideon. So when you're a member of the European Union, there are some things which, if you like, you've sort of delegated, you pooled, and that's things like a trade policy, like regulations. But I mean, other things are still within the bounds of the nation state. So you can do cultural exchanges, you can do sort of sciencey stuff. But a lot of the absolutely kind of key economic stuff is still very much at an EU level, not at a nation state level.
And what are the two sides trying to achieve here, and how successful do you think they'll be?
Well, I guess it depends on how you try to measure it, Gideon, right? I mean, if you're thinking, is this going to be like when Britain was in the European Union? And it's worth reminding ourselves, when it was a member of the European Union, there were absolutely no barriers to trade whatsoever, no regulations whatsoever. It was just the same to sell stuff from Britain to Berlin as it was to sell stuff in where you are in Manchester to London. I mean, it was all one. That is just not coming back. So I think the kind of things that this treaty is designed to deal with is perhaps just sort of some of the frictions that crept into the relationship, and of course some of the sort of things that you would expect to make a difference on a bilateral level. So, you know, cultural exchanges, making it easier for people to see each other. But I think you have to be realistic. This is not Britain rejoining the European Union, and unless Sir Keir Starmer has some massive change of heart, you know, Britain still has a very distant relationship with the European Union. It has the hard Brexit left by former Prime Minister Boris Johnson.
And the key things here are the customs market and the single market. The customs union and the single market, aren't they, Rob? Just explain for our listeners what that means for Britain being outside those two things.
It's just fabulously costly. I mean, I think it's been estimated at something like costing Britain £100 billion a year in lost trade and economic growth and development, which is absolutely massive amount. And why has that happened? Well, a customs union means that essentially you share exactly the same tariffs with the rest of the world. So, you know, the trade policy of Germany, Bulgaria, all the members of the European Union, so the rest of the world are the sort of same. That's no longer the case. And the other huge barrier is no longer being in the single market. And just to remind ourselves, the single market just means, you know, regulations, product standards are the same everywhere. So when you're selling products from, you know, Germany to Britain before Brexit, there was no need for all these expensive checks we were just hearing about.
Rob, thanks very much for that. And Keir Starmer will also be going to France. He's due to meet Emmanuel Macron on Thursday. Well, I've been speaking to Wolfgang Weber, the head of the Electro and Digital Association in Germany. It represents over 1,000 companies, including some really big firms like Siemens and Bosch. I asked him how Brexit had affected his association's members.
Brexit has had some negative impact. Trade has not been that easy since then, although both parties have tried hard to keep things as good as possible. But yes, if we look at the figures in terms of exports and imports, the trade relation has declined. So that is why it's so good that hopefully with the new prime minister, focus will be on reinventing good old times.
So the British Prime Minister is in Germany today. They're talking about agreeing a new treaty of some sort by the end of this year. How important do you think that treaty could potentially be for the companies that your association represents?
Any treaty that would improve particular business relations will help. It could include something such as harmonized standards, or when it comes to trade relations, it could, you know, harmonize the so-called rules of origin. But of course, it could also go beyond that when we talk about a customs union. But that probably will take much longer time. But to have a start now for this year, that is what it is very good.
It's easy to see why this treaty would be important to Britain, because Germany is Britain's second biggest trading partner. But I was just looking at the figures, and actually Britain is quite a long way down the list of Germany's trading partners. Germany is much more focused on China and the US and then the Netherlands and other countries within Europe. So I wonder, maybe this treaty is more important to Britain than it is to Germany, and maybe your focus there in Germany is elsewhere.
Sure, there are other partners that have a bigger market than the UK has. But given that there's so many similarities between the UK and Germany, it seems relatively easy to come to common terms. So there's no reason not to try to get on a good treaty, even though, yes, you're right, there are other partners, other markets that are bigger than the British one.
And let's focus on the German economy itself. It contracted slightly unexpectedly in the second quarter of the year. A small contraction, just 0.1%. But some of the data coming out recently hasn't been good. I'm thinking of the Purchasing Managers Index that we saw last week, the IFO Business Sentiment Index this week. So when you talk to your members, what do they say are the problems that they're facing at the moment?
You're right. The overall sentiment is not as good as it should be, and we believe it could be. Although there's also some distinct differences between the different subsectors. So when we look into everything that is around electrification, there's still very good business and also very relevant growth figures. While when it comes to everything that goes into machinery, into industry, things look worse. What needs to be done is some EU internal kickoff to, you know, invite for more investments. Investment figures, and that is what concerns us most, have declined. And Germany and Europe need to invest more. And for that one, we need a good investment climate. We need policymakers across Europe to come up with a good plan how investments are made more attractive. We have seen that in the US, how investments have been made more attractive. We need a similar plan also for Europe and for Germany.
Wolfgang Weber there in Frankfurt. Joining me now is Russ Moll, Investment Director at AJ Bell. Russ, one of the other points that Mr. Weber made to me when we were talking, he said that the last European Commission, the most recent European Commission, has increased bureaucracy a lot. And it's a complaint that you hear more and more across Europe these days, isn't it? Whether it's farmers complaining about environmental regulation or in other sectors as well. So this was, of course, one of the reasons why half of this country voted to leave the EU. How stifling is EU bureaucracy at the moment? And have we in Britain seen any benefit from being free from it?
I mean, you've even had debate within the European Union itself, Gideon, about, for example, digital media, where Thierry Breton, the commissioner there, was accused of overreaching himself when he intervened in Elon Musk's X feed and some of his social media output. So there will be champions of Brexit who believe that, yes, the reason that one of the good reasons that the UK left, in their view, was to escape EU bureaucracy. The British government is looking at that, or the previous government and the Conservatives are looking at that with insurers, for example, to release insurers from Solvency II capital requirements so they could get money off their balance sheet, get it invested into the UK economy. So it'll be interesting to see if the Labour government carries on with that. But at the same time, there is no doubt about it. If you talk to retailers, for example, they found that there is now more bureaucracy as a result of Brexit at the borders. And so at the moment, it's still very much 8 years on. Both sides are still arguing about whether they were right or wrong to vote to leave or vote to stay in.
Yeah, and those arguments are undoubtedly going to continue.
Yeah.
Stay with us, Russ. One of the problems that the UK faces as it tries to breathe more life into its economy is an ageing population. There are about 67 million people in the country, and nearly 15 million of them are over the age of 50 and economically inactive. And that figure is increasing. But some companies are going out of their way to recruit those older workers. Our business reporter Simon Browning has been finding out more.
Sewing, snipping, steaming. Here at home retailer Dunelm's made-to-order curtain factory in Leicester, in the heart of the UK, more than half of the team is over 50. A seamless blend of youth and technical experience. With no sign of retirement, Ali and Mags want to keep using half a century of learned skills.
68 next month.
And you, Ali?
I will be 65 in about 4 weeks.
She's a good worker, Ali?
Yeah, she's a great worker. Everybody loves her. Part of the success of a factory would be having a good age range mix. And I think you need that mix. We can pass on the skills to the younger generation.
A quarter of those who work for Dunelm are older workers, those over 50. It's almost 3,000 people. They actively recruit this age group, targeting them on Facebook and in job centres. It appears to be working. Amanda Cox, Dunelm's stores and people director, says the retailer is growing and opening new stores, a rare achievement.
We have a very flexible approach to different types of shifts. I've had colleagues chat to me in stores or in here, and they'll go, I'm retiring, and I'll go, we really don't want you to retire. Have you considered staying on in a seasonal contract so that, you know, you can just come in for less weeks of the year, but it still keeps you connected?
There are 11.1 million economically active over 50s in the UK economy. That's either in a job or actively looking for one. That's up 320,000 in the last 5 years since before the pandemic. But there's 14.8 million economically inactive workers over 50, and that's up 1 million in the last 5 years. Getting some of those back to work would be a big boost for the UK economy.
With so many workers out of the jobs market, many have challenges getting back in, as Stuart Lewis, founder and CEO of Restless, a digital community for the over 50s, tells me.
We often talk about this cohort of people as being the sandwich generation. So often they will be primary carer for their elderly parents who are often in their 80s or 90s. Sometimes they'll still have dependent children and teenagers at home. And that can have a big impact on their ability to navigate work.
Come in. Well, this is my home, which is also my workplace.
In rural Buckinghamshire, in the south of England, Kay Flannery teaches students from around the world English at home, offering bed and board.
In the evenings, we often sit round here and watch a film on TV or some interesting sport or documentary or something like that. And this is the table where we have our lessons. This is our kitchen. And Tony and I prepare food here for students. Students often love to help us prepare British food. And they also very often love to produce something from their hometown or something. So we've had the most brilliant Japanese food, Italian food, food from everywhere. Yeah,
job satisfaction is really important. And I think having some sort of structure for the week.
The income, I don't usually think about that too much, but it's always good to have. But mostly for me, it's just meeting a whole load of interesting people and having interesting things to research a bit.
With almost 900,000 job vacancies in the UK economy, drawing on the skills of the UK's older workers could be a boost for much-wanted economic growth.
Simon Browning reporting there. All this week, we'll be looking at the challenges and the business opportunities faced by ageing populations. On Thursday, we'll be in Singapore, and on Friday, in Kent.
Hallo, wir sind Julia Becker und Chris Sommer vom Podcast Drinnies. Hunde sind ja eher keine Drinnies, die wollen mehrfach täglich raus und mit anderen spielen, muss jeder selber wissen. Wer so viel unterwegs ist, sollte allerdings auch gut versichert sein. Die Tierkrankenversicherung von Petolo bietet euren Hunden und Katzen Vollschutz, das heißt OP und Krankenschutz.
Mit dem Gutscheincode Drinnies sichert ihr euch einen kostenfreien Probemonat, mit dem ihr einen Monat lang alle Petolo Services nutzen, sowie eine Videosprechstunde bei Dr. Fressnapf unverbindlich und kostenfrei testen könnt. Alle Infos dazu findet ihr auf petolo.de/drinnies.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the latest exchange of fighting between Hezbollah and Israel. Does it bring us closer to a regional war? And will ceasefire negotiations for the Gaza conflict, the root of it all, ever come to an agreement? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah. World Business Report from the BBC World Service. To American football now, because the National Football League, the NFL, has taken a historic step which could transform the financing of the sport and possibly boost its appeal outside the United States. The owners of the 32 NFL teams have voted overwhelmingly to allow private equity investment for the first time. Until now, NFL franchises have generally been run as family businesses or owned by wealthy individuals. James Wickham from our newsroom has been looking at this and joins me now.
Yes.
James, what have you found?
Well, this is all about 2024 resolution JC7. And I don't want to overexcite you with that, but that's where we're up to. Now, look, what that does is that allows institutional investors to partially own NFL franchises. It means that private equity funds can purchase up to 10% of any franchise for passive ownership. Very briefly, what is private equity? You might be asking. Well, it's stock in a private company that does not offer stock to the general public. And usually that's for an investment into that company, which you can then help manage and gain the returns from. With this, it's a little bit different. So essentially, the funds are capped at investing in a maximum of 6 teams. And the minimum investment for institutional wealth in any franchise is 3%. So if a fund buys into a team, it's going to hold on to that investment for a minimum of 6 years. The funds must have a minimum of $2 billion of committed capital to invest. So we're not talking about small amounts of money here. And a maximum of 20% of a fund's money can be invested into one team. Now, right, all of this means the league has provisionally approved 8 funds as 4 potential groups of buyers of any available franchise sales. I could go through the list, but there's various different ones. But I think one of the major questions here, Gideon, is about foreign investment.
Absolutely. I was just about to ask you, are foreign, will we be able to invest ourselves if we're not based in the US?
Well, not entirely. but a bit, maybe. Sovereign wealth funds, such as Qatar, Saudi Arabia, the wealthiest sovereign fund, which, quick pub question for you there, is actually the Norwegian government pension fund. They are not allowed to invest into teams directly, but they can own one of those approved funds, or I should say part of those approved funds. No individual or single investor, such as a sovereign wealth fund, can own more than 7.5% of any fund. So this is very much a small part of those teams that they are now being allowed to own that they were never allowed to own before. We should say the NFL is the last of the major sports leagues in the US to allow this private equity funding as well.
Let me bring Russ in here. Russ, I understand you're an NFL fan. You tempted to invest?
Long-suffering Washington Commanders fans, so not in them, no. But also, they've just been bought by actually a private equity magnate, Josh Harris, last year for $6 billion US dollars, the highest price paid for any NFL team in history.
Right. And James, I noticed that the head of the NFL has insisted that these companies won't get a say in how the league is run. So it sounds like they're kind of wanting their cake and eating it at the same time.
Absolutely. I mean, that seems very much the case. But I think for the private equity funds, and maybe Russ can say more, but it feels very much as though they just want a piece of that pie because the NFL is such a huge money-making juggernaut. Now, the things from the NFL, some of the owners have been talking. The owner of the Kansas City Chiefs said the teams could use the private equity for multiple reasons: stadium-related issues, family-related issues, changing capital structures for owners and their families. All of this can come in. But yes, this is, I think, I mean, again, Russ might be able to tell me more. I think this is very much the first bit of this, you know, that we could well see this expand in future.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll see what happens. James, thanks for joining us. Now, an oil tanker, which was attacked by Yemen's Houthi fighters in the Red Sea last week, is still on fire. And according to the US Pentagon, at least, it may be leaking oil. If it is, that's a major concern because the ship, called the Sounion, is carrying more than 150,000 tons of crude oil. To put that into context, that's about four times more than leaked out of the infamous Exxon Valdez oil tanker when it ran aground off the coast of Alaska back in 1989. I've been speaking to Arsenio Dominguez, the head of the United Nations International Maritime Organization.
Of course, it would all depend on what would be the kind of oil spill, the meteorological conditions, etc. There are several factors that we will have to look into it if an environmental disaster was to occur. Right now, we're working with other agencies that can provide satellite imagery. There's no real proof on an oil spill right now. We have models, similar situations. You probably remember the FSO Safir, which was have a large amount of oil off the coast of Yemen. It was a stricken platform storage unit. And of course, should an oil spill of the amount of oil that is currently in this vessel was to occur, because the main is the economic and environmental impact. Fisheries will suffer greatly. The coast of Yemen and neighboring countries will also be affected, plus the long-term negative effect that it has on the environment, both the flora and the fauna in the region.
And what's the procedure for dealing with a stricken ship like this where there is an oil spill?
We have specific processes that are in place, and we carry out training with member states, all part of the International Maritime Organization, in order to prepare for this. First, of course, is the salvage operations, and those are very well established. Then is the containment of any oil spill, providing the necessary equipment in order to carry out this, as well as the training that we give to people of the maritime domain in countries around the world in order to be able to respond to this. The first part is always the containment, and then afterwards, if there is an oil spill, of course, move on to the cleanup operation.
And this is made all the more difficult, isn't it, by the fact that the Houthis are threatening to attack the ship again and potentially attack the salvage operation?
That's correct, because this is completely outside the control of the maritime domain. This is geopolitical situations having a negative effect on shipping, when shipping is only providing those necessary trading for everyone around the world. And of course, it's being targeted in a very cowardly and unjustified manner.
And in this case, the 25 crew members of this ship thankfully have been rescued, but it just goes to show how dangerous it can be for seafarers sailing through the Red Sea. Give me an idea of just how they have been affected since this crisis started at the end of last year.
I'm very grateful for the rescue operations that took place, because the most important thing for the International Maritime Organization is always to focus on the safety and security of the seafarers first, because they are innocent victims of this. And of course, we shouldn't accept a single death or a single casualty from these attacks. So far, there's been four casualties. And I said, we shouldn't have a single one, but there's been four casualties that have taken place. And of course, we continue to work with all stakeholders and countries in order to find ways to protect the seafarers.
So four people killed, and there have been people kidnapped as well, and huge disruption to shipping throughout the Red Sea and the area.
Which is affecting everybody. And thank you for highlighting, again, the Galaxy Leader, which of course, you know, they have been detained since November last year, which is completely unacceptable. And I'm working with all the member states that can reach out to those that are perpetrating this in order to find solutions. It's quite a challenge, but we will not rest until we actually get our seafarers back and go back to trade in the way that it's supposed to happen, so everyone around the world continues to benefit.
And the Houthis say that they've been attacking ships in solidarity with the Palestinians in the war between Israel and Hamas, but there doesn't seem to be much logic to the ships that they're attacking. Many of them don't have any links with Israel, as far as we can see.
This is a very evolving situation. And of course, there's always going to be different aspects that are taken into account when we look into the ships that have been attacked. For us, what is important is not a single ship, regardless of the nationality, regardless of any connections, should be attacked, because they are there to serve you, to serve me, to serve everybody else in the planet.
Arsenio Dominguez there from the IMO. And we should say in the last few minutes, there's been a development in this story. The EU mission in the Red Sea has said there's been no oil spillage from that tanker. So the Pentagon says there has been leaking oil. The EU mission says there hasn't. We'll keep following that story. Russ Moll is still with me. A couple of markets stories for you, Russ. Results out from China's biggest electric vehicle maker, BYD, a 24% rise in first half net profit. And they're really targeting overseas sales now, aren't they?
They are. I mean, the share price shrugged down 2% on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange today. Now it's one third down from its high. I think part of the reasons for the overseas push is the Chinese market seems to be slowing down. There are still doubts over the strength of the Chinese consumer. But on the overseas market, there's lots of competition there. There's talk of a lot of price cutting going on. And if they go overseas, they do face tariffs as well. So that's why they're looking, for example, to build factories in Turkey to try and find their way around those tariffs and get themselves into the European Union.
Yeah, it seems odd that they are so buoyant about overseas sales given the tariffs.
Yeah, I guess they obviously think they have a plan to work their way around it with these overseas facilities that they're planning, but they'll certainly be bumping into an awful lot of very familiar names when they try and get there.
And also later today, Russ, NVIDIA earnings, a lot of attention will be placed on those. What are we expecting? They'll be after the bell in the US later today.
They'd better be good. This is the world's second biggest company by stock market valuation. It's the best performing stock on the American stock market this year, and the numbers are expected to be very strong. Sales up by more than double. Net profit up by more than double, with further improvement in the third quarter expected. And it may almost be what Jensen Huang, the boss, predicts for the third quarter. That'll be more important than what he says for the second. The company's developed a very good habit of demolishing earnings forecasts. And some are suggesting that Mr. Huang has been fairly cautious with his outlook for this quarter because he's predicted sequentially flat profits. So he may have sandbagged them a little bit. But analysts are looking for very strong sales and profit growth from the world's leader in AI semiconductor chipsets. And if it disappoints, there could be a little amount further market volatility to follow what we saw in early August.
Yeah, and some of the analysts are saying that we could see a share price movement in, well, certainly in the billions, given the value of NVIDIA.
Given its market capitalization is $3.2 trillion, even the smallest percentage movement would see billions of dollars changing hands potentially very, very quickly indeed, yes.
So we'll have more on that story on NVIDIA in our later edition of World Business Report with Davina Gupta. She'll be talking to an investor who put money into the company back in the day and is now a whole lot richer as a result. But for now, that's the end of World Business Report. Thanks for listening.
I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the latest exchange of fighting between Hezbollah and Israel. Does it bring us closer to a regional war? And will ceasefire negotiations for the Gaza conflict, the root of it all, ever come to an agreement? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.